Hi there, I'm Barry Forward, and welcome to the Reboot Forward podcast. This is the podcast where we take a deep dive into the wonderful world of change, reinvention, transformation, and just plain doing something different. In particular, how it impacts the people who go through that change, what they've learned from their journey through change, and ultimately, what has allowed them to reboot forward. My guest today on the podcast is David Morley, my friend David Morley, president and CEO of UNICEF Canada. David and I have known each other for over 35 years when we were both involved in a small Canadian NGO called Pueblito, which promoted the rights of children. David is now one of the more passionate voices you'll hear for the world's most vulnerable citizens, and he has dedicated his career to improving the lives of children and communities in Canada and around the world. Since leaving Pueblito, he joined in 1998. He became the executive director of Doctors Without Borders Canada, and then he moved on to Save the Children Canada, a post he held. He was CEO and president there, a post he held until he took up the current role he has with UNICEF. His career has taken him all over the place, all over the country, all over the continent, and all over the globe, to humanitarian projects, including countries across Africa, to Iraq, Mexico, the Dominican Republic, and a whole host of other countries in Central and South America. He's the author of two Canadian best-selling books, Under the Tree, which he co-wrote with his wife Elizabeth Morley, and Healing Our World, Inside Doctors Without Borders. David has taught at the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy at the University of Toronto, and he sits on the advisory council of the Institute for the Study of International Development at McGill University. He's also co-chair of the Stephen Lewis Foundation. In recognition for all this work that he's done over the years, David was appointed to the Order of Canada in 2018. Here's my conversation with David Morley.
I think change does it means opportunity. It's, that sounds like such a it's such a cliche, but for me the change is an opportunity. It's an opportunity to build something better. And even in a time like we're in, where things are difficult, where the change seems bad, I guess basically I'm an optimist. So I think no, it means opportunity. It can be an opportunity to reach out to other people in a different way, in a new way, what we're going through right now. It means change. It also is changing ourselves, right? It means, you know, here Canada is very different than it was when you and I first met, these many years. and there's been a lot of change. And so we have to change inside ourselves as well, I think, to take advantage of the change in and see it as opportunity.
The work you do is for children. That's the only way. Yeah. I'll kind of simplify it that way. And we're in the middle of this this crazy time, whatever you want to call it, pandemic, COVID-19 era. Yeah. And I read somewhere that the beginning of September, you said something like, I hope Canadians wake up and have a look at themselves, at least at how we're treating kids. Like, I don't know if that's the exact quote. It's probably not, but something like that, right?
Yeah, because right in last month at UNICEF, we put out our report. We do these reports every 18 months or so, global reports of child well-being in wealthy countries. And these stats, it's comparing statistics amongst the world's 40 wealthiest countries. And it's 40 or so, like it depends how we can get comparable stats for. And over the last decade, Barry, things have not got better in comparison with our peer countries in Canada. And it it's amazing to me that children and young people themselves, you know, we see some things are objective, like one in every five Canadian children lives below the poverty line. We have growing rates of child obesity and adolescent suicide in a wealthy country like ours. But young people's own reporting of what they're getting, which we might say as adults, we might say, well, that's more subjective, but still it's darn important because it's what they're saying about themselves. When they feel bullied, when they feel marginalized, not part of a group. And this growing income inequality that we've got, one of the things we've seen is that the children in the middle, and we're still a middle class country, but the children in the middle class who have enough probably, but they're anxious as they see the inequality because that they're going to drop into the poverty, and the children who are at the bottom don't think they can make it up into the middle. And even the wealthy kids are afraid of fall. So it's creating this as we become more stratified, that mental health becomes more and more difficult for more and more children. So it's, and then I think with the pandemic, you know, whenever there's a disaster, I think of Haiti, the earthquake in Haiti, a physical disaster. And I remember being there and it's like, wow, society's broken open in this physical disaster. And you just see how incredibly dysfunctional it is, how hard it is for poor Haitians, most Haitians. And that's what I feel like this disaster that we're in with COVID, it's here. And just for our society, it's kind of broken it open. And we've seen, whoa, look what it means for racialized kids, for poor kids, for Indigenous kids, all these the kids who are losing out, particularly on an education in Canada. That we see it more clearly now somehow, I think. And when we're all saying, you know, it's a lovely slogan, I believe in it. I believe in what we're trying to do in Canada, but you know, creating this new kind of country that is not based on ethnicity, but is based on common values. And there aren't a lot of countries in the world that are doing that. And somehow the pandemic has shown us where we're not living up to our mythology and our rhetoric, because we're seeing that so many kids are getting left behind.
So in the pandemic, I saw a stat was 150 million more kids living below the poverty line worldwide or something. Yeah. How is that reflected in Canada? What has that meant in Canada?
Well, here we've got the resources, you know, all the money that's been going into the wage support and trying to keep that happening. We're seeing that it's kind of holding its own these months. The question is, how long can we afford, you know, how long will we choose to afford to go on doing it? And the longer term results are that poorer kids are falling behind on some of their medical, routine immunization and just doing all the preventative stuff you go in anyhow, right? Going in for checkups and stuff. And it's that poorer kids, at least here in, and I say here being in Toronto, but I see this happening also in Montreal. I don't know what the stats are saying in Vancouver and Western Canada. Poorer kids are less likely to be going to school. They're doing school remote because those poorer neighborhoods have been harder hit by COVID. And so parents are more anxious. And we know that online education is not the same as in-person education. And if those kids start losing a year, losing a year and a half of school, it's going to be really tough to make it up. And that's where we need to have a collective effort to say, I'm willing to pay, I'm middle class, I'm willing to pay some more taxes if that's what it's going to mean at the end of this thing to, you know, when we're able to go back to school, we're able to see each other in person again, if it's going to mean that children can do catch up at school, if they can have, if we'll hire more teachers and make that investment in public education. Because public education, we always complain about it, right? And yet in these cross-country surveys that we do, that UNICEF does, public education is one of the places where we perform. We're not at the top, but we're in the top third of countries. Whereas in general well-being, we're in the bottom third. And that also says to me, when we choose to make an investment, as we have in education, well, we can make it work. It's good. That's good, right? So, you see, I'm grasping at straws, Barry, but it's well, my optimism.
Yeah, and I guess you know, we think as Canadians think, hey, we're all this money. I mean, you hear big numbers thrown out, or they're being thrown, subsidies, et cetera. But still the numbers show us, like and you know the numbers better than I do, but it was the average of countries like ours spend about 3% of GDP, and we're spending 1.5% on kids, right?
Yeah, and that's why, you know, people will say, wow, how do they do it in the Netherlands and Norway and Finland? Or, you know, those are the places that are near the top. And that's it. You nailed it. They spend about 3% of their GDP on children, and we don't. We spend less. We've chosen to spend less. We make our choices as a society. And that's, you know, for us, what we see, there's three things that make a really profound difference to child well-being, the things that cost money. There's investment in quality daycare and early learning, like preschool early learning. So even when kids start kindergarten, they might have had a year of early learning. It's play-based. I mean, it doesn't mean they're sitting there, you know, writing tests and stuff. It's play-based learning and quality childcare before and after school. Then it's improving the parental leave so that kids will have, when a child is born, that they've got parents have better support so they can be with their kids. And we're getting better in Canada, but still, you know, those countries in Northern Europe have got better than we do. And then income support for the poorest families to reduce that gap. And then you go, you know, you get some people will say, well, you can't give income support because it won't be spent on the kids. Well, it usually is. Like, it actually is spent on the kids. If you know, tying it in, we have the Canada Child Tax Benefit. And actually, that has lifted a lot of kids out of poverty. So since it came in 3 or 4 years ago. But again, it's a societal choice, I think, that we have to make. Are we willing to make that investment? Because, boy, you see studies like that you make places where you make those early investments, you end up as the children or our teenagers or get into their 20s. There's you don't have the same huge gaps in society. You don't have the same issues around crime. People feel they belong more to society and they're well enough educated and healthy that they can really participate. That's one of the things that we heard, is that for many of the young people, like real, like children who've been on the streets, kind of kids that you and I knew long ago, that what they want is the feeling of belonging. And then they belong. They're part of our Canadian middle class family society. That's what they want, and those early investments in kids will help them feel they belong.
What needs to change? Is it just you mentioned it's sort of like we've accepted it, this is just how we've chosen to deal with it? And it seems to me like it's, you know, if I went and walked to my neighbor and said, hey, were you doing enough to support kids, they would say yes.
Yes.
We
you know, that I think we need to, we live in such an incredible country with such incredible potential, right? I mean, all our natural, everything, our natural resources are, and so our myth becomes, well, therefore it must be great for kids. Must be, right? And I mean, absolutely, it's certainly better than a lot of places in the world, but when you compare us with the rich countries, it's not what we should be. So we have to try and, I don't know how you overcome myths, because myths are really hard to overcome. You know that. So there are some things that we can do. These are very bureaucratic sounding, but they could make a difference. New Brunswick has started a thing called a child rights impact assessment, so that when they're going to have legislation coming through, we've worked with the government of New Brunswick on this, so that it's put through a lens of an impact on children's rights, what a legislation might or might not do. And that, okay, you get politicians looking at children's rights in a different way and trying to reduce the unintended consequences. In the Convention on the Rights of the Child, world's most signed human rights treaty, they suggest that a country should have a commissioner for children at the federal level. We do not have this. It's just somebody to think about kids when you're governing, you know? And therefore, thinking about kids, Scotland is one country, and we haven't seen how it all plays out yet, but they lowered the voting age to 16. And so, okay, you got kids, you know, we've seen people like Greta Thunberg and others, right? Young people are leading change in leading the discussion in some ways. Let them vote. They're going to be around a lot longer than I am. So, you know, and there's nothing magic about being 18. You know, you're 16, you can drive a car. And it used to be couldn't vote till you were 21. Used to be it was only men like you and me, Barry, who were able to vote. I mean, there's nothing fixed about that. And it could start changing the discussion, I think. But we need to, as I say, those are kind of bureaucratic sounding things, but it's listening to kids who, you know, young people have some good ideas. We're doing a thing. There's a global thing. It started in Latin America called Child-Friendly Cities. And it looks at a whole bunch of, because also now with most, you know, the majority of the people living in cities too, it's listening and looking at kids, having kids participate a little bit in the, and it could be little kids too, in what do they want to make their city more livable. It's usually playgrounds, and we kind of playgrounds, no big deal. But we also know play-based learning is huge for kids, and that getting into playgrounds is a way where they learn to take risks and all of the. So it's listening to kids, even little kids. And this child-friendly cities movement, you know, it started in Latin America. It's in Europe now. It isn't. There are a couple of cities in Canada that are expressing interest in it: Edmonton, Guelph, Ontario, a few in Quebec. And it's a way to start to share, oh, okay, these might be a different way that we look at some issues if we really take kids into account.
So you speak to the bureaucratic changes. I would call it political influence or something, yeah. As well as the dollar side. And so my neighbor, she's interested. She thinks she's helping kids right now. We think we're doing a pretty good. We live in a great place. I'm paying my huge tax bill. It's going to... you know, all these things, and I think it's going to kids. What should she do? What would be the first formative action that she could take to say, this is how I'm going to move forward to support kids the way you're talking about here?
I think that talking to politicians is one of the first things. Like, okay, here in, you know, in our city, we pay taxes too. And we started a little petition on our street to get, there are a lot of kids on our street, and including our grandchildren who live with us, and to get speed bumps so that cars would slow down, you know? So there's one thing. So you start to get a bit of political activism to say, just in my neighborhood, right here, I want to make things better. And, you know, from there to writing to, you know, contacting our members of parliament if we are believe in making things better, be it provincial or federal, right? And then the provincial and the provinces and the feds start arguing about jurisdiction, which just drives me crazy because we're just talking about kids. Forget the jurisdiction, just do it. But you know, raising those issues. If you talk with politicians about children's issues, they will start to listen because they want to be reelected. And then it's volunteering. You know, I think, you know, and be it volunteering in Canada or someplace around the world, we work a lot with different children's hospitals and the YMCA, Big Brothers Big Sisters, Boys and Girls Clubs of Canada, to like where that we all come together to advocate for some of the political change, like the bureaucratic and political change that we want. But those are great organizations that are doing good stuff for children and young people. So it's volunteering with a local children's organization and recognizing that coming together as we all raise our voices. And that's where, like, where we as UNICEF get involved, because we say, yeah, we're in the Convention on the Rights of the Child. We have that responsibility. So we've had the YMCA and the Boys and Girls Club start coming to us and saying, okay, what can you do to push this issue with politicians? Because we're all stronger when we have one big voice together. And it's getting the leaders in the private sector as well, I think, who are, you know, there's good people there. And they, I think the private sector during the pandemic has realized they need to behave. Something needs to change about their, you know, some of those people who talk about the triple bottom line, you'd know all that stuff better than me, Barry, but that the social role of business, I think that's becoming clearer to us. It's not just a matter of extracting the maximum profits and putting them wherever. It's no, there's responsibilities to the community where we work, communities where we work. They've got to do that.
UNICEF Canada. Yeah. Is an extension of UNICEF, the big organization. And one of the, you know, with the pandemic, a lot of talks about a vaccine and
yeah,
all this. And you have been really, I would say, influential in pressuring government to keep in mind the need to distribute equitably, yeah, particularly. So how is that working from a Canadian standpoint?
I think we are seeing, well, first of all, yeah, you're right. This COVAX thing, of course, there's an acronym. The global, to make sure that the vaccine goes to the poorest countries once we have one. We are involved in that very much because UNICEF already before the pandemic, we procured about 45% of the world's vaccines for children. Which we would then send to the poorest children. We used to procure more than half of the world's vaccines, but the government of India, about 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, they started doing it all themselves. And so that's why we dropped below the 50% mark.
It's a good thing. It's a good thing.
It's a fantastic thing. Absolutely. Absolutely. So here it's really, we're still in Canada. It's advocating both with the government. We're saying, you know, you got to be sure it reaches everybody. So our discussions, but it's also, I think, with all of us, you know, the vaccine hesitancy, where once there is a real vaccine that is done, that has followed all of the steps that it needs to get done. And I think some people are anxious and, well, rightly so, if they think a vaccine is going to be rushed through without going through all of its safety tests. But once we know that something has gone through all its tests, then it's going to be public education about the importance of taking the vaccine, just like it is for the flu vaccine or whatever. And not being hectoring for people who have vaccine hesitancy, it's going to be talking with people and trying to show there's no question, you know, and Barry, I don't know if we're allowed to get personal, but that you and I, I'm taking advantage of that, those children, so can I say it on air? Barry and I worked with street children many years ago.
Well, I was gonna go there after you just wrapped up there. I was gonna say, okay, back in 1982, when we first met, and that's where this journey began for me. You've been working since the late 70s, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. With kids and street kids in Latin America, yeah, is what it was. Yeah. So.
Yeah. But you know, many of those back then, when we started working in international development, so many millions of kids were dying from preventable causes. And the biggest change, you know, we've seen we've seen that drop by 2/3 the number of kids who are dying. So when you and I were working, it would have been about 25 million kids a year were dying, 25 million were dying. And now we're at about, well, pre-pandemic, down to about 6 million kids a year dying. So that's more than 2/3. And vaccines are one of the biggest reasons, measles, mumps, rubella, all those things that we need to be able to show that vaccines work and they save lives. And yeah.
So going back, let's go back to those, maybe have a little history here. Cause the question I was going to ask around, I mean, we met a long time ago and you've done lots, Doctors Without Borders, Save the Children, all these things that you've been involved in. What is, you know, here we are 2020. It's a massive impact that's happening on kids today. Is this the biggest thing you've seen? Or is this, you know, what is this in the scale of things as it relates to its impact on kids?
Oh, it's no question, Barry. Education and health and education are huge ways out, you know, for kids to get out of poverty and for countries to get out of poverty, right? And earlier this year, almost every child in the world was not going to school. Right? Education just stopped. And, you know, we were talking earlier about the losses here in Canada, particularly for poorer children in Canada. But at UNICEF, we've been trying to, how do you reach kids in rural Central America, let alone rural Niger or even urban places in Africa or some of the children are at risk of losing, being out of school. And if they're first generation learners, you know, so their parents had never gone to school, but their parents are finally convinced, okay, maybe, you know, I think of a country like Burkina Faso, which is a place where I've done a bit of work and with kids whose parents had never gone to school. Well, parents are going to go, look, they stopped school. It's not that worth it after all. Come on, kids, get back in the farm. You know, I don't mean it all to sound facetious, but what we know is that when girls aren't going to school, they're more likely to end up being married young. And that's happening more and more as the poorest families, because of the pandemic, it shut down economies and therefore young kids are going out on the streets. They're going into sex work. More girls are being sold in early enforced child marriage. And in an urban shanty town, and you're asking people to self-isolate, which is hard enough because you've already got five people living in one room, the domestic violence is going up. So everything that we're afraid of and we're concerned about and that we're thinking about here in Canada, but we've got the resources to at least try and deal with it a little. It's not that the poorer countries in the world don't want to deal with it, but they don't have the resources. They don't have the fiscal resources to be able to put all the investment in. So this is like nothing that has ever hit children. Maybe the Spanish flu, which I think, to the best of my knowledge, was mortality. This isn't the mortality. This isn't the direct mortality. We know that. We know that COVID-19 doesn't kill kids directly, but the impact is phenomenal. And how we can try to reimagine, okay, it's 2 years in the future, And we're talking about Congo Brazzaville. How are we going to help kids really get back to school in that country, in another country, work together with people? And, you know, I mean, and I say the work together because often it's as though, oh, we're, you know, Canada, the wealthy countries of the world, to the rescue. No, it's not that, because we know that every country is filled with people who want to make things better for their kids and for their society. It's finding those partners and working with them and teachers and nurses and even sometimes politicians who really want to make things better.
Well, the thing about it is, I'm just hearing it. We go back to 1982 and 1983 when I was in the Dominican Republic where I was in the backyard schools and the whole thing. It just seems like we're rolling back the clock. going back, we made all this progress. You talk about 25, 23 million, whatever the number was, down to six. Wow.
Yeah. But we don't know how it will go forward. But then you get these creative ideas, you know, the backyard schools. I've been talking about those backyard schools, actually, Barry, because in Uganda right now, the government, they're calling it something different and all, but that sense of the backyard schools for your listeners were, I mean, heck, you knew them better than I did, but they're essentially private schools, except they're schools and not what we conjure up when we think of private schools, right? It would be somebody with like a grade six education, maybe, who would set up a school in their backyard for a little bit of childcare and basic literacy and numeracy for kids, because the public system couldn't take them in, wasn't good enough to take them in, wasn't robust enough, that we got to help with. And what a privilege, hey? I mean, that was... And in Uganda, they're talking now about the same thing and trying to figure out how to do that. And there may even be private investors. And it's an interesting model. Private investors who may say, I'm willing to make an investment in this school, because there's going to be a bit of fee paying, because then the parents will be able to do a bit more work, and then they'll pay just like people here pay for private schools. But that may be a way to expand it out much, much bigger. We're just trying to think through other creative ideas to, if the regular flow of resources dries up, that may be a way that we can move forward. But yeah, I love those backyard schools, eh? They were great.
So I was thinking, if you took at that time, we're talking the 80s, early 80s, you took this middle-class kid, me, you know, I graduated from university, but and plunked me into this scenario. What a window on the world that I was given. And I consider myself so fortunate. I wish I had have had more to give the community when I went down there. That's my only, if I had a regret about it, but what I learned from it and the path it took me on was because of that exposure, I'll call it, that awareness that I was gifted on. It was by happen chance that I wandered into your office. It was by luck. I walked by an officer's little notice. That's how I got there. So,
yeah. And isn't it? And then I think when we're given that gift of seeing that other way in the world and knowing that we're not going to be able, like, to having the humility to go, whoa, like, I'm out of my depth here, but if I'm learning stuff, if I can make friends, and then keep that in my heart when I come back to Canada. I mean, I couldn't have framed it that way when I went either. You know, having gone, what, 3 or 4 years before you, that made me a grizzled veteran. And it is a gift, right? Because you can never look at our country or the rest of the world in the same way.
One of all these stats that I was reading when I just prior to this was the kids being happy, and it was something, a happiness. You said, I think it was 55% when they were unhappy in Canada or something, a stat like that when they did the survey. And what I just going back and kind of tying it into what I saw back then was in these poor communities, in these home with 10 people living in one room, like with a bed in the back and a makeshift thing, and the content happiness that was would come out of these people.
Yeah.
Right. And just to compare it to that today's state where we I'd say adults are wrestling with it, our happiness, let alone. And so I don't know. Yeah. I just share that story because it really, that's what I think about all the time. Is like, I'm complaining here. What the heck do I have to complain about? You know?
Yeah.
But as a little kid, I'm not in control of that. Right.
Yeah. And if our kids here in Canada, you know, if they feel this, they feel the fear and concern of their parents too, they're going to start feeling, you know, that and the pressure for the parents of trying to be sure that we're able to keep up with the Joneses. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, you look around our middle, this is the sea in which we swim. So of course we want to stay with that. But down in the Dominican Republic, it was a different sea. So I guess people were able to be happier there. There seemed to be less pressure, eh?
It was eye-opening for this young guy down there looking, going, huh? You know, they have nothing.
Yeah.
Zero. I mean, less than nothing is the only way I can describe it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we've been talking a lot about the kind of the tough things that kids are facing and tough plight of all worldwide, with the pandemic and everything. I'd like to end on a positive note and talk about, because you said it at the beginning, you know, you're hopeful, you're positive, you're positive about it. What is there to look forward to for kids?
I think that if we use some of this technology that we're using now, like out of the pandemic, if we make the investment in this, because one of the things is that this technology of Zoom and all of this, it's destroyed geographic distance. I mean, it's amazing, you know, like I'm sure the same, like I'm just talking with everybody. I mean, people all around the world, just like this. And I never leave home. I mean, and I think that will help us understand things in the future, you know, in the future. We do. I think that the pandemic, I believe it can be a wake up call for us to go, we will be, you know, just what we were saying about the people in Santo Domingo, who there was that happiness and there was that sense of community. Well, maybe we can regain that sense of community because I think that has a lot to do with happiness, right? Because you know you got people you can count on. You know you got people that know you. We can be middle class enough that we still get our privacy, but you know that there's folks around. That's if we can turn the rhetoric that we've heard in this pandemic into a reality, I think we're going to be fine. I think we're going to be. It's going to be tough the next year, 18 months, but. Then I think we'll have learned enough and we can set a different course for us for our kids and grandkids.
So if someone wanted to contribute to UNICEF Canada, I have to ask here, where do they go? Is there a website? Or even if they want to get a hold of David Morley?
That it's I'm really bad at doing that, you know, at saying that it's unicef.ca. That's our website. You can get to us through there. The report that I was talking about is there, and stuff about what we're doing with vaccines around the world is there. Everything's there. It's the magic of the internet, right? UNICEF.ca. And thanks for asking that.
Well, thanks, David. And great to connect with you after a couple of years,
Time. But look, I mean, that's part of this technology too, right? It's a long time since we've talked, but it's as though it's been no time. But that's also friends, right? You know, you make friends at important times of life and then you're still friends.
Absolutely. Yeah. I have a personal question, might not ever use this on the podcast, but I'm going to ask it. The Stuart McLean name of his characters. Now, please tell me about that. Like, how did that happen? How did you get the moniker to get onto his show, become an icon? You are a Canadian icon. Well, Stuart McLean,
yeah,
obviously.
Stuart was. Yeah. Vinyl Cafe and Dave and Morley. Stuart and I played hockey together, and our sons are the same age. And his boys, well, who are now men, so his kids went to the school where my wife was principal. So we were close families, right? And I had a skunk moved into, actually right underneath where I'm sitting now, moved into our house 30 years ago, 25 years ago, I was asking all my friends here, how do I get rid of a skunk? And Stuart said, I've got this summer replacement show, and this is a great story. Tell me more. Tell me more. So I told him about all the stupid things that I had done, things that Dave does on the show. And Elizabeth, whom you know, my wife, had some fairly pertinent observations on some of the stupid things I tried to do. And Stuart, so as a thank you, he was going to call he created the character. He hadn't given Dave a wife yet. He created Dave, and Dave was his name because his producer was Dave Amer. But his producer's wife was named Elizabeth. And so Dave Amer said, you can't call her Elizabeth because that's my wife. People think it's me. So Stuart, as a little gift to us, said, okay, I'll call her Morley. And it was an incredible gift, eh? I've even had once at airport security back in the days when we used to fly, I was showing my ticket and the security person went, have you ever heard of the Vinyl Cafe? Just walk on through, sir. Cause when he saw my name, it was a lovely gift that Stuart gave, you know. We all lost a lot when we lost Stuart.
Well, he obviously had someone, a good role model to write the character on.
Well, yeah, to the stupid things that Dave did. And I always have to tell, please tell your listeners, I never did that with the turkey, you know, that he did in that Christmas thing. I never did that.
And thanks again to David Morley for taking time out of his busy schedule to connect with me after all these years. And thanks again to you for listening to the podcast. If you would like to connect with me or any of the guests that appear on the show, send me a note at barry@rebootforward.com. That's barry@rebootforward.com. Until next time, let's reboot forward.